What do those men say? Before their disabilities are removed, they say, "We will remain quiet until all of our disabilities are removed, and then we shall again take the lead." Why, Mr. Speaker, in my state, since emancipation, there have been over 500 loyal men shot down by the disloyal men there, and not one of those who took part in committing those outrages has ever been brought to justice. Do we then really propose here today, when the country is not ready for it, when those disloyal people still hate this government, when loyal men dare not carry the stars and stripes through our streets, for if they do, they will be turned out of employment, to relieve from political disability the very men who have committed these Ku Klux outrages? I think that I am doing my duty to my constituents and my country when I vote against any such proposition. The parties in Georgia were now three. The conservatives, who represented the former planters, the scalawags and carpetbaggers, or radicals, who stood together as a commercial capitalistic group, and a moderate group who held the balance of power. The legislature of 1868 was evenly divided between conservatives and radicals in the Senate, but the House had a majority of the conservatives, and after the exclusion of colored members, the conservatives had a majority in both, 25-19 in the Senate, 127-48 in the House. When the legislature was reorganized in 1870, the radicals had a majority in both houses, 27-17 in the Senate, 87-83 in the House. In the election of 1871, the moderates threw their power to the conservatives, and the combination gained two-thirds of the seats. Negroes in the Georgia legislature introduced numbers of bills. Senator Campbell not only introduced bills for education, but on the jury system, in regard to churches, concerning the city government of Savannah and of Reedville, on pleading and practice in the courts, and on better government of cities and towns. Most of these were reported back by the various committees with recommendations that they pass. The number of Negro members was reduced to 26 by the death of Representative Lumpkin of Macon County. He had spoken little, but his vote could be counted on always for worthy bills. Although several other members of the General Assembly, 1868-1870, had died, in no case was the resolution of eulogy so pronounced as that concerning Lumpkin. We cheerfully record our appreciation of his modest worth, his integrity as a man, a citizen, and a representative. Turner introduced the following bills: to establish a state police, to secure chaplains for convicts, to enforce an act donating lands to the Georgia State Orphans Home, to amend the Constitution of Georgia so as to enable females to vote, to appropriate the state capitol and the governor's mansion at Milledgeville to educational purposes, to repeal an act to amend the several acts now in force, regulating the fees of magistrates and constables in the state of Georgia so far as relates to the counties of Bibb, Richmond, Monroe, and Lee, and to provide for the mode of collecting the same, approved January 22, 1852, and the several acts amendatory thereof, and to prescribe the costs in insolvent cases due magistrates and constables in this state, to add an additional section to the 9th Division of the Penal Code, also a bill declaring certain persons husband and wife. Turner's resolution extending sympathy to the inhabitants of Richmond, Virginia, who had just suffered a terrible disaster, was adopted by the House. The Negroes in the General Assembly seem to have had a special interest in correcting the methods of maintaining and managing the penitentiary of this state. Representative Turner offered several resolutions for reform in the system. This penitentiary system began to characterize the whole South. In Georgia, at the outbreak of the Civil War, there were about 200 white felons confined at Milledgeville. There were no Negro convicts, since under the discipline of slavery, Negroes were punished on the plantation. The white convicts were released to fight in the Confederate armies. The whole criminal system came to be used as a method of keeping Negroes at work and intimidating them. Consequently, there began to be a demand for jails and penitentiaries beyond the natural demand due to the rise of crime. Federal officials began the custom of leasing the convicts to private persons for work. This system was extended by Bullock, who leased 500 victims to a firm of contractors. The legislature of 1871 confirmed this lease, and in 1876, the Democrats hastened to order a 20-year lease of convicts, which began the horrible system of convict leasing, and gave to the state a profit in crime, not to mention the vast profits which came to the private contractors. Naturally, then, the colored members of the legislature, even before this system was settled, were interested in securing better conditions for convicts. Senator George Wallace and Representative James Sims served on a joint committee from the Senate and the House, respectively, to ascertain the number of inmates and how they were treated. Peter O'Neill offered a bill for the abolishment of the penitentiary system. As a result of this movement, changes were made in the drastic methods used to punish convicts. This amelioration led to the issuing of many pardons, for which the Bullock administration was severely criticized. The most energetic Negro on the Standing Committee on Penitentiary Investigation was Representative J. M. Sims of Chatham County. He had spoken only twice in 1868. On his return to the General Assembly in 1870, Sims offered many bills to amend an act for the more efficient preservation of peace and good order on election days in this state, to repeal an act prohibiting the sale and purchase of agricultural products in the counties of Lowndes and Macon, to incorporate the Chatham Mercantile Loan and Trust Company, to repeal the act passed in 1869 to encourage immigration into this state, to repeal the local laws of Savannah and Chatham County, so far as relates to the fees and costs of justices of the peace, notaries, ex officio justices, and constables in criminal cases and warrants, to provide for the reopening of the books of registration by the clerk of the Common Council of the City of Savannah. Two of these bills passed. The last two were indefinitely postponed. Representative Porter was prominent. He was born in Charleston, South Carolina, of free parents. Before the war, he was a member of the Underground Railroad, and he opened a secret school in his home. He was a music teacher and tailor by trade. In 1856, he had won some distinction in music, which led the bishop of the Episcopal Church in Savannah to have him to come there to train a choir for the St. Stephen's Episcopal Church. After the war between the states, Porter opened an eighth-grade private school, and later on, he was called to be the principal of the first Negro public school in Savannah. He left this position to become the first principal in the public school of Thomasville, Georgia. While there, he published his first book, English Grammar for Beginners. Finally, he became principal of a school in Yazoo, Mississippi. Porter was especially prominent in the Negro conventions, which preceded the state conventions of 1867. Jefferson Long was sent to Congress from Georgia. He was born in Crawford County in 1836, educated himself, and went into business as a merchant tailor in Macon, Georgia. He was elected a representative from Georgia to the 41st Congress by a majority of 900 over Lawton, a Democrat. He was admitted to his seat January 16, 1871. The record of the Negro in the Georgia legislature is creditable, and yet Clark Howell afterwards declared Negro members of this legislature were unlettered, ignorant politicians who seemed a stack of puppets and harlequins of a menagerie. Outrages and guerrilla warfare against Negroes were widespread in Georgia. General Lewis of the Freedmen's Bureau reported 260 attacks, whippings, and murders of freedmen between January and November 1868. In September, there was a race riot at Camilla. Nordoff found about 1875 that the Negroes in and near the cities and towns were usually prosperous. There are many colored mechanics, and they receive full wages where they are skillful. Near Atlanta and other places, they own small truck farms and supply the market with vegetables. There are fewer black than white beggars in the cities, and a missionary clergyman surprised me by the remark that the blackberry crop, which was ripening, was a blessing to dozens of poor white families whom he knew, who lived half the year, he said, in a condition of semi-starvation. There are many colored mechanics, and they are all thrifty people and very commonly own the houses they live in and often a town lot besides. In the cotton country, an increasing number of colored men own farms of from 40 to 100 acres, but many of these were free before the war. In the towns and villages, the colored people have a prosperous look. They dress neatly and very commonly live in frame houses. On the whole, their condition appears to me very comfortable and satisfactory. He gives these facts. In an official report of the Comptroller General of the State for 1874, giving the character and value of property and amount of taxes returned by colored taxpayers for that year, the number of colored polls listed was 83,318. These returned an aggregate value of taxable property amounting to $6,157,798, on which they actually paid $30,788 in taxes. They owned 338,769 acres of agricultural land and city and town property to the amount of $1,200,115. Now, remembering that these people were slaves only 9 years before, I think it clearly establishes that, first, they have labored with creditable industry and perseverance, and, second, that they have been fairly protected in the rights of life and property by the democratic rulers of the state. I do not think that colored people in any other state I have visited own half as much real estate, or indeed a quarter as much, as those of Georgia. The difficulty of securing adequate wages led to a Negro labor movement. This step was undertaken by two Negro leaders, Congressman Jeff Long and State Representative H.M. Turner. Their purpose was to organize a union among Negroes, demanding a minimum wage of $30 a month for field hands and $15 for women. The convention received considerable notice, and the employers condemned it. There were strikes in Macon and Daugherty County. In Houston County, there were agitation, and county associations of field hands were attempted. But this movement for rural unions was not very successful. Georgia was thus a state where a coalition of planters and Negroes began before Reconstruction, but while the planters advised the Negroes and made fair promises, they took no active part with them. When the new political life began, the planters and the poor whites combined to put the Negroes out of the legislature. The carpetbaggers and scalawags formed a moderate bloc and fought with the planters to gain control of the poor whites. In this way, they succeeded and were able to ignore the Negroes, bribe white labor with silence, and make commerce and business triumphant in the state. The carpetbaggers and scalawags spent money extravagantly, but they spent it in their printing and contingent funds with Southern merchants and supply houses, thus combining capitalistic interests. Georgia does not present the stock picture of a state looted by outsiders. It looted itself. Reviewing the events recorded from the beginning of this chapter, we observe that the period of Reconstruction in Georgia was not a period when a swarm of harpies took possession of the state government and preyed at will upon a helpless people. The Constitutional Convention of 1867-1868 forebodes such a period, but when the conservatives rouse themselves, from that time on, the stage presents an internecine war between two very well-matched enemies. This struggle is usually represented as between a wicked assailant and a righteous assailed. That it was a struggle between Republicans and Democrats is much more characteristic. In such a contest, mutual vilifying, of course, abounded, and it is not to be supposed a priori that the vilifying of one party was more truthful than that of the other. None were more proud of the extravagance that accompanied this building of the commercial state than white Georgians. They welcomed the bearers of northern capital, then as now. The most extraordinary man in the Reconstruction history of Georgia was Hannibal I. Kimball, who was a capitalist interested in railroads and often associated for business purposes with ex-Governor Brown. He was especially close to Governor Bullock and was a focus of bribery and corruption. He was a type of a class of aspiring northern men who have rushed to the South since the war, some to run plantations, some to open mines of coal and iron, some to build railroads, others to establish great hotels, and all to give a grand impulse to Southern progress and show the old fogies in the South how to do it. Many of these enterprising men have already come to grief and left the country, while others are in full career to Fortune, or her eldest daughter, Miss Fortune. Kimball has been, of course, represented as bribing Negroes, but what Kimball and his kind bribed was the city of Atlanta, the state of Georgia, and the whole South. And while he doubtless gave his tens and hundreds to Negro legislatures, his thousands and tens of thousands went to that vast majority of white men who saw in him and his methods the salvation of the new capitalistic South, and who made the wealth and advertising of Atlanta overshadow the old-fashioned conservatism of Savannah and Macon. Moreover, Georgia was not ruled by carpetbaggers. Facts do not warrant the description of the Reconstruction government of Georgia as a Negro carpetbagger combination. There were some of both classes in the Constitutional Convention and in the legislature of 1868 already mentioned, and many in the federal service, particularly as Internal Revenue officers, but they generally held minor positions. The planter candidate for governor, who opposed Bullock, testified that in 1870, no more than a dozen former non-residents were holding office in Georgia, and that the judges appointed by Bullock were entirely satisfactory. The economic boom of Georgia was evident. The value of total property rose steadily from $191 million in 1868 to $234 million in 1871. By 1870, the cotton crop of Georgia had surpassed the largest crop raised under slavery, a proof that Negro labor had not been demoralized by emancipation. Manufacturers increased during 1860 to 1870, and the lumber business greatly increased. There had been 643 miles of railroad in 1850, and 1,420 in 1860. By 1870, this had increased to 1,845 miles and 2,160 in 1872. This business and industrial prosperity of Georgia was largely at the expense of the laboring classes. The educational system was started, but it received little support. Instead of preventing crime, crime was deliberately increased by the convict lease system. The poor, the blind, and the insane were neglected, and although peasant farmers, because of the high price of produce, were able to buy some land, there was no effort to place large numbers of small owners on their own farms. There was no real labor legislation. On the other hand, capital began to receive large returns, and speculation was rife. It is of especial interest to note that in Georgia, where the native white man never lost control, there was practically the same increase in debt and the same railway scandals. There was graft in printing, advertising, and attorneys' fees, and the state debt was greatly increased, so that including endorsed railway bonds, it reached a total liability of over $20 million in 1872. It may be gathered from this that extravagance and theft in the Reconstruction South was a matter neither of race nor of geography. Rather, it was a question of poverty, opportunity, and current American morals. Nevertheless, there were in Georgia the same charges of theft and waste as elsewhere, and the same final desire to shoulder the blame on the Negroes. In the election of December 1870, there was a large Democratic majority in both houses of the legislature, and the Democrats continued in power. Bullock, foreseeing impeachment, resigned in October 1871. The legislature met in November. In December, there were several investigating committees. Robert Toombs became prosecuting attorney, and the investigations were thoroughly partisan. Railroad manipulation in Georgia, as elsewhere, led to Wall Street, and many fanciers of New York, like Henry Clews and Company and Russell Sage. The acts granting aid to railroads were passed by votes of members of both political parties, and the state is considered secure against loss if the law be properly enforced. The lease of the state-owned railroad undoubtedly involved corruption, but among the leasees were former Governor Brown, Alexander Stevens, and Ben Hill, in addition to H.I. Kimball and others. Naturally, no Negroes were involved, except as possible recipients of bribes. Representative Turner seems to have worked hard to secure more reasonable terms, payment only after the work was actually finished. Bullock himself was charged with many financial frauds, but none of them were ever proven. His worst deed, the establishment of the convict lease system, was not held against him, but adopted by the state with avidity. Florida had long been a refuge for runaway slaves, and the desire to reclaim these slaves had led to the so-called Seminole Wars and the final annexation. There were 27,943 whites and 26,534 Negroes in 1840, the first census after the state entered the Union. In 1860, there were 77,746 whites and 62,677 Negroes. There never were as many as 1,000 free Negroes in the state before emancipation. Florida was a poor state with a small population. It had been dominated by rich planters, and the poor whites had had little opportunity. The state, therefore, in many respects, resembles South Carolina rather than Alabama, in that the black man was the dominant labor, and no white proletariat ever ruled. On the other hand, black labor never came to self-assertion, while planters and carpetbaggers manipulated it from the first and gerrymandered its representation. White rule was ever in control, but it was only partially proletarian in character. Although there were hundreds of Negro soldiers in the state at the time of Johnson's proclamation, he ordered a convention based on white suffrage, and the convention met October 2, 1865. It was composed almost entirely of Confederates, and the message of the provisional governor, Marvin, gave them encouragement. It is doubtful if there was any noticeable opinion among the whites in favor of Negro suffrage. Certainly, Marvin spoke decidedly against it. It does not appear to me that the public good of the state, or of the nation at large, would be promoted by conferring at the present time upon the freedmen the elective franchise. Neither the white people nor the colored people are prepared for so radical a change in their social relations, nor have I any reason to believe that any considerable number of the freedmen desire to possess this privilege. The convention finally said, "The people of the state of Florida in general convention assembled do ordain and declare that while we recognize the freedom of the colored race and are desirous of extending to them full protection, we declare it the unalterable sentiment of this convention that the laws of the state shall be made and executed by the white race." The convention sat 12 days and adjourned for the ensuing election. E.S. Walker was elected governor. He recommended the removal of black soldiers from the state and advocated various black laws. He said with regard to Negro suffrage, "Each one of us knows that we could not give either an honest or conscientious assent to Negro suffrage. There is not one of us that would not feel that he was doing wrong and bartering his self-respect, his conscience, and his duty to his country and to the Union itself for the benefits he might hope to obtain by getting back into the Union." A commission of three was appointed to report laws concerning the Negro. They recommended a county criminal court, mainly for Negro offenders, and the same discrimination against emancipated slaves, which had been used formerly against free Negroes. They were not sure how they could keep the Negro at work, and they were tearful concerning his future. "If, after all, their honest efforts shall prove unavailing, and this 4 millions of the human family, but recently dragged up from barbarism, and through the influence of Southern masters elevated to the status of Christian men and women, shall be doomed by the inscrutable behest of a mysterious providence to follow in the footsteps of the fast-fading aborigines of this continent, And when the last man of the race shall be standing upon the crumbling brink of a people's grave, it will be some compensation to the descendants of the Southern Master to catch the grateful and benignant recognition of this representative man as he points his withered finger to the author of his ruin and exclaims, "Thou didst it." The black laws of Florida followed, to save them from the ruin which inevitably awaits them if left to the tender mercy of the canting hypocrisy and mawkish sentimentality which has precipitated them to the realization of their present condition. There were the usual vagrancy and apprenticeship laws, and laws against firearms. On the other hand, there were laws regarding marriage and the right to testify in court, but only in matters in which Negroes were concerned. After the federal law of June 21, 1866, a large number of Negroes flocked to Florida. From 1865 to 1867, the chief thought of the freedmen of Florida, as in other states, concerned itself with what the government was going to do for them with regard to farms, and they were victims of many speculators. The duel in Florida for the control of labor was between two sets of northern men, mostly federal office holders of various sorts, and the planters. The policy of the planters was so to shift their influence between the northerners so as to gain their ends by political strategy, which they finally did. At the same time, they made some effective efforts to keep in touch with the Negroes so that they retained a good deal of influence over their vote. When the elections of 1867 under the Reconstruction laws were about to take place, the Negroes sought to get in touch with leading white Southerners. One meeting was held in Leon County, and several white planters invited to address it and give the Negroes information as to their newly acquired duties as citizens. This increased the rivalry between the planters and the carpetbaggers, with the result that the planters made few further open efforts to cooperate with the Negro voters. The Southern whites tried to kill the convention by refraining from voting, so that the total vote cast was 14,503, of which all but 1,220 was cast by Negroes. In the convention of 1868, 46 delegates were returned. 18 of these were Negroes. Of the 27 whites, 2 were conservatives, 15 carpetbaggers, and the rest Southern whites. The most cultured member of the convention, probably, was Jonathan Gibbs, a Negro. Gibbs was a tall and slightly built black with a high forehead and a color indicating mulatto origin. His voice was clear and ringing. He possessed some of the qualities of a born orator and a genuine sentimentalist. E. Fortune, another colored member, was a native of Florida with a fair education, courageous in his opinions. Among other colored leaders were Armstrong, Oates, and Wallace, who wrote the history of Reconstruction in Florida. The convention which met January 20, 1868, had a colored man of Tallahassee, C.H. Pierce, as temporary president. He was not a strong man and was later convicted of technical bribery, but on the whole, his advice and effort seemed to have been sincere, and he had the confidence of large numbers of colored people. Of the 46 delegates, there were only 20 present. Richards, a white man of Illinois, who, as Wallace says, had been only 2 days in the county from which he had been returned, was elected permanent chairman. Richards, however, struck the right tone in his speech. He said, "We should provide for a system by which all may obtain homes of their own and a comfortable living, and also provide for schools in which all may be educated free of expense. Clothe honest industry with respectability, inaugurate a public sentiment that shall crown the man with honors as the benefactor of his race who makes 2 blades of grass grow where 1 grew before, and prohibit all laws that are not equal and just to all within our state." The first difficulty was a matter of money. There was only $500 in the treasury, and the convention had to issue scrip to pay its expenses. This scrip circulated as less than par value and made the expenses appear much larger than they actually were. Two factors early developed among the carpetbaggers, and the policy of the planters was to wait and take advantage from time to time of the outcome of this internal fight. This left the Negroes in a peculiarly helpless condition, and it was only the ability and sanity of men like Gibbs that enabled them to make any headway at all. On the second day of the convention, an ordinance was passed forbidding the sale of property for debt, suspending the collection of taxes, releasing all persons held to labor for non-payment of taxes, but not forbidding the laborer the right to collect wages from his employer. It was distinctly legislation in the interest of labor. The convention had been in session about 2 weeks when the planter took a hand. The two factions among the northern white leaders were the conservative Osborne faction, which leaned toward the planters, and the more radical Billings faction, which sought complete control of the Negroes. The Osborne faction and the planters, under the leadership of ex-Governor Walker, succeeded in breaking up the convention so that nearly half of it seceded and went off secretly to a neighboring town to work on a constitution. This rump convention adopted a constitution and sent it to the federal general of the district for his approval. They then took a recess. Afterwards, they returned to Tallahassee, broke into the legislative hall at midnight, and declared themselves the rightful convention. General Meade intervened and made the two factions come together and adopt a constitution which proved to be mainly the constitution drawn by the seceders. This constitution was a peculiar document. It put vast appointing power in the hands of the governor, making him a practical dictator of the state, and it was also charged that the basis of representation was so unfair that less than one-fourth of the registered voters would elect a majority in the state Senate and less than one-third a majority of the Assembly. 6,700 voters in the rebel counties elect as many senators as 20,282 voters elect in Union counties. 7 senators are elected by 3,027 voters in rebel counties, and only 1 senator is elected by 3,181 in Union County, Leon, and 23 voters elect 1 senator in a rebel district. In the Assembly, 8,330 voters in rebel counties choose 27 members. Madison County, Union, with 1,802 voters, sends 2 representatives, while the rebel sent from Dade County has a constituency of 8 registered voters. This was accomplished by discriminating against the localities where the Negro vote was large, so that the Negroes never had in the legislatures a representation anywhere near as large as their population called for. The Constitution relieved the former Confederates from taking the registration oath. Charles Sumner and others opposed the admission of the state under this Constitution, but nevertheless, after a delay from February to June, the state was admitted. In the election on the Constitution and for state officers, Billings was the candidate of the radical branch of the Northern white leaders, and the planters nominated a Confederate cavalry colonel, but in reality, threw their support to Harrison Reed, the candidate of the Osborne faction which had made the Constitution. The Republican ticket, headed by Reed, received 14,421 votes. The Democratic ticket, headed by Scott, 7,731. And the Independent Radical ticket, 2,251. In the first legislature, there were 17 Republicans and 8 Democrats in the Senate, and 36 Republicans and 15 Democrats in the House. Of these 76, 19 were Negroes, 13 carpetbaggers, 21 Southern Loyalists, and 23 conservatives. Harrison Reed was a Johnson Democrat and formerly chief postal agent in Florida. He was present at Johnson's inauguration as an unofficial representative of the state and was a strong opponent of Chase. He was a curious character. Like Warmoth of Louisiana, he was an adroit politician and was repeatedly threatened with impeachment, but he was not as unscrupulous a grafter as Warmoth and exercised his great power with considerable care. His policy always was to favor the planters as much as possible, and then, when the Negroes or Northern whites revolted, to yield to them sufficiently so as to retain their support. In his cabinet, the more important places went to ex-slaveholders. The number of Negro members in subsequent Florida legislatures is not clear. Wallace mentions 25 colored members of the House in the legislature of 1873. The number of representatives in the legislature who could neither read nor write during the 7 years of carpetbag rule in Florida was 6, of whom 4 were white. Under the Constitution, the governor appointed all of the chief state officers, except the lieutenant governor and judges, and also he named most of the county officers. Nevertheless, the Constitution of 1869 gave the Negroes the right to vote and gave Florida its first approach to a real government of the people. Reed's administration started out with strength and respectability, but it was weak because of lack of recognition of the colored people. His opponents, therefore, tried one method of attacking him by introducing a civil rights bill, compelling hotel keepers and railroad companies to receive Negroes on the same terms as whites. The bill was passed in the Assembly, but the governor called in members of the Senate and explained why he thought it was not wise to push such legislation. Colored people became alarmed, but through Pierce and other leaders, their apprehensions were allayed. The ill will against Reed began when electors were chosen in November 1868. Impeachment proceedings against him were begun, but the Supreme Court ruled that there was no quorum in the Senate at the time. The Secretary of State, Alden, had joined in the opposition to Reed and was removed. Gibbs, the colored leader, was selected as his successor, which greatly increased the strength of Reed among the freedmen. The ensuing turmoil in Florida cannot be understood unless one keeps carefully in mind just what was taking place. The planters were encouraging lawlessness and inciting the Negroes to make extravagant demands for equality in order to embarrass the carpetbaggers and excite the poor whites. The carpetbaggers and northern capitalists were seeking to get rid of Reed and bribing white and black members of the legislature in order to get through special legislation for capital. The Negroes were trying to find a program of labor legislation which would help and uplift the masses. Reed was playing capital, labor, and planters against each other, and in the midst of these contradictory and opposing forces, the state staggered on. The governor informed the legislature that the past 7 years of anarchy and insurrection had left nothing in the treasury, with $600,000 of debts and a large amount repudiated. The former inadequate school fund had been robbed of its last dollar to aid the Confederate forces. The railroad system, half completed, was bankrupt. The revenue laws inadequate. No schools or school systems. No benevolent institutions, no almshouses, penitentiaries, and scarcely a jail. In the first Reconstruction legislature, Negro leaders, Harmon and Black, tried to pass a school law for the education of the masses. At the second session of the legislature, a homestead law was passed and the school laws amended. Acts of violence throughout the state continued, and there was considerable bribery in the legislature. The second session of the legislature met January 5, 1869. There was a second attempt to impeach Reed, foiled by the action of two colored members, H.S. Harmon and E. Fortune, and finally defeated by a vote of 43-5. An extraordinary session of the legislature was called May 17, 1869, on account of financial difficulties and matters connected with the sale of the Pensacola and Georgia Railroad and the Tallahassee Railroad. Railroad legislation was introduced, Littlefield and Swepson, already operating in North Carolina, being connected with the matter. State aid was asked at the rate of $12,000 a mile for these railroads, which would amount to $4 million. Wallace says that members of the legislature were openly bought, white men receiving from $2,000 to $6,000, and colored men $500 or less. There were disturbances in various counties and open violence and bloodshed in 1868-1869. Reed was asked to declare martial law, but instead he sent Secretary Gibbs to the centers of disturbance. Gibbs received close attention from the colored people and openly attacked the carpetbagger leaders. The legislature met in January 1870 in its third regular session. The governor repeated a statement which he had made before. In several counties, organized bands of lawless men have combined to override the civil authorities, and many acts of violence have occurred, but these have been incidental to the state and all its past history, and arise less, perhaps, from special enmity to the present form of government than from opposition to the restraints of law in general. It is true that these same localities, being to all intents border sections, have from time immemorial been the resorts of lawless and reckless men, and in some of them, as in earlier periods of the existence of the western and southwestern states, the law of Judge Lynch and the regulators for years before the war had been the only code of much efficacy. I had hoped better results from the reorganization of government under Republican auspices, but the bitterness resulting from the war, the noxious teachings of disappointed and defeated political opponents, assisted by the occasional lack of discretion on the part of injudicious political friends, succeeded for a long time in setting at naught the advice and the efforts of the better men of all classes, until improvement at times seemed to be hopeless, and I have been strongly and forcibly urged to the declaration of martial law. Again, an attempt was made to impeach Reed, but the colored members stood by him. The impeachment committee sent in two reports, a majority report, signed by four, and a minority report, signed by one. The minority report, which was adopted, said, "Looking back over the history of the state for the last 10 years, so full of excitement, agitation, and turmoil, we are profoundly impressed with a sense of the value of the results of the reconstructive legislation of the national government and its subsequent result in the organization of our own state government. We feel bound in duty to call attention to the many difficulties and embarrassments, particularly of a financial description, with which, in the administration of a newly organized government, Governor Reed has found himself continually surrounded. Without sympathy, with scanty resources, without the support from a portion of his cabinet, as it appears from the testimony and from official documents, called to fill a multitude of offices by the appointment of comparative strangers, he must have been seriously embarrassed and hampered on every hand. After deliberate consideration of the charges, the evidence, the surrounding and difficult circumstances, and in view of the results that may be expected to follow the action taken, we do not find the charges preferred to be so far sustained by the evidence given as to warrant us in recommending an impeachment." The report was adopted by a vote of 27-22. All the colored members of the legislature, except one, voted against impeachment. In 1870, the Democratic Party put in nomination Bloxam for lieutenant governor. The Republican politicians declared that if Bloxam was elected, they would unite with the Democrats so as to impeach Governor Reed and make Bloxam governor. Wallace thinks that Bloxam was in fact elected, but counted out by the returning board, of which Gibbs, the colored Secretary of State, was a member. He says that Gibbs consented with great reluctance and under threat of impeachment if he did not yield. It must be remembered, however, that Bloxam was the friend and mentor of Wallace and edited his book. The legislature met in January 1872 and again sought to impeach the governor. The more ignorant of the members of the assembly were secured to vote for the impeachment. A southern county judge was promised appointment as a circuit judge, and a Democratic member of the assembly was promised a share of the new bonds. Ex-Governor Walker promised the support of the Democrats. The governor, in his message, complained that more than two-thirds of the bonds issued in aid of Littlefield roads had been wasted without any real progress. The bonds were entrusted to firms of swindlers in New York. Impeachment proceedings were based on this, and the governor was suspended from office, but the trial was never held, and at an extra session of the legislature, he was restored to office. There had been much corruption in every legislature under Reed, but Wallace says, "The colored members at this session began to show more manhood by openly denouncing the tricks of the carpetbaggers and refusing to be enslaved by caucus rule." They showed their independence by this resolution introduced by Daniel McInnes, colored, of Duval County. "Whereas it appears that after several attempts to have a civil rights bill, which gives to every citizen the same protection in the enjoyment of his liberties, And whereas it has become a painful fact from the action of Liberty Billings, acting president pro tem of the Senate of the state of Florida, and others who are opposed to seeing the colored citizens of this state enjoy the same rights that he and his associates do, we again witness on today another defeat of the Civil Rights Bill caused by only those who profess to be our friends in connection with this great cause of civil rights. Therefore, resolved that we, the colored members, and those who honestly sympathize with us, do unhesitatingly repudiate such friendship, and do now and henceforth withdraw from and decline from ever affiliating with, politically, or to aid in electing any such man or men who have so basely misrepresented our people. These resolutions were ruled out of order. McInnis was fought and denounced in his county and lost the next election to the legislature, although one of the most faithful and honest representatives of the colored people. The delegation elected from Leon County, all colored, stood opposed to the system of plunder which had been inaugurated in almost every county of the state. This was shown when Gleason introduced a bill to authorize corporations to change their names and consolidate their capital stock, etc. The measure was adopted by the Republican caucus, but when the matter came up for final consideration, the Leon County delegates opposed the bill, and John W. Wyatt, a Negro, made a speech which was the first ordered spread on the minutes of the legislature of Florida. "We want no Tom Scotts, Jim Fisks, or Vanderbilts in this state to govern us, by means of which they would influence legislation tending to advance personal interests. The great curse of Florida has been dishonest corporations, rings, and cliques, with an eye single to their central interest, and if this bill is suffered to pass this assembly, in my opinion, we may look for a continuation of abuses and a usurpation of the rights of citizens who may be opposed to the evil machinations such as are generally exerted by consolidated bodies." The recent expose of the Tammany Ring in New York has satisfied all right-thinking men that the power exercised by strong bodies composed of many corporations is the most dangerous to the public good and safety. Therefore, it ill becomes us to pass a bill enveloped in darkness, as the title to this bill indicates it to be. A last attempt was made in this session to impeach Reed. Wallace says, as one of the members of the committee, "I never saw the report of the investigating committee, nor any other evidences upon which the subsequent articles of impeachment presented by the committee were based." After a long and intricate fight, Reed, supported loyally by his Secretary of State, Gibbs, outgeneraled his opponents. However, Reed was not renominated, although the colored people wanted him. The planters now felt strong enough to assert themselves and secured the selection, as Republican candidate for governor, of Justice O.B. Hart. The carpetbaggers filled the rest of the ticket, except that the freedmen received recognition by the nomination of J.T. Walls as one of the candidates for United States Representative. The campaign was bitter, and the results of the election close. The Republicans carried it by a small margin. Hart was the first native governor of Florida in Reconstruction times, but was a vacillating and uncertain man. The legislature met in January 1873 and nominated a colored man, Scott, for speaker. He was defeated by the revolt of the colored delegation from Leon County on account of his connection with politicians. In return, the white leaders insisted that no colored man was fit for a cabinet position except Jonathan C. Gibbs, and he, they charged, had attempted to count in Bloxham in the previous election. The Negroes insisted on Gibbs. Hart refused until the colored members in caucus demanded Gibbs' appointment, with a threat that they would otherwise combine with the Democrats and clog the wheels of the administration. Colored members of both branches of the legislature went to Hart in a body, and finally he had to accede to their demand. Gibbs was appointed superintendent of public instruction. Gibbs held this office during 1872 to 1874, when the school system was tottering and the collection of funds difficult. He virtually established the public schools of the state as an orderly system. But when a student of Florida history recently tried to examine the records of his administration, he discovered that they had all disappeared from the state archives. The extraordinary political complications of the day are illustrated by Hart and his cabinet. Hart was a Southern planter backed by carpetbaggers, and his Secretary of State was McLean. Wallace says, "The cabinet was a very fair one, with the exception of McLean, who was a deserter from the rebel army, and being self-condemned for his own treachery for having volunteered in the Confederate service and then deserted before he smelled gunpowder, he was satisfied that neither the Democrats nor the carpetbaggers cared to trust him, and he was therefore the tool of the most rabid and unprincipled members of the carpetbag dynasty of the state." In 1873, Gibbs and the trustees of the Agricultural College frustrated an attempt to invest the $100,000 received from the general government in bonds, which would have put the cash in possession of the politicians. When Hart died in 1874, Stearns became governor. He wanted to ask the resignation of Gibbs, but Gibbs was too popular. Stearns had promised to nominate Gibbs for Congress, but was afraid that he could not control him. Gibbs was in perfect health before the meeting of the convention and during its sitting. He delivered a powerful speech in the Stearns convention, attacking one of his supporters. He went home and ate a hearty dinner, after which he suddenly died. It was whispered and generally believed that he was poisoned by some of the carpetbaggers because they dreaded his growing popularity. His brother, Judge Milflin Gibbs of Arkansas, gives a different cause for his death, but notes his fear of assassination. "My brother, Jonathan C. Gibbs, was then Secretary of State of Florida, with Governor Hart as executive. He had had the benefit of a collegiate education, having graduated at Dartmouth, New Hampshire, and had for some years filled the pulpit as a Presbyterian minister. The stress of Reconstruction and obvious necessity for ability in secular matters induced him to enter official life. Naturally indomitable, he more than fulfilled the expectations of his friends and supporters by rare ability as a thinker and a speaker with unflinching fidelity to his party principles. I found him at Tallahassee, the capital, in a well-appointed residence. But his sleeping place in the attic resembled, as I perceived, considerably an arsenal. He said that for better advantage it had been his resting place for several months, as his life had been threatened by the Ku Klux. It was my last interview or sight of my brother. Subsequently, after a 3-hour speech, he went to his office and suddenly died of apoplexy." In the legislature of 1873, there were 25 colored members, of whom 19 were in revolt against the political leaders. The methods of the white politicians were illustrated in the case of 2 colored members who wished to inspect the state prison. Everything was done to impede them. A special train was prepared for the comfort of the visiting guests, but it left just 2 hours before the time designated, and the colored men were left behind. But the Negroes were energetic and determined and reached the grounds by other means. The warden at once set out liquors and cigars, but the colored men refused to partake and went about their investigation. The Civil Rights Bill finally passed at this session without great opposition. The matter of land distribution continued to come up, and the northern politicians assured the freedmen that they favored high taxes upon the lands of the ex-slaveholders so as to compel them to sell these lands cheaply. On the other hand, they accused the planters of being in favor of low taxes so that the whites could hold the land and rent it to the colored people. This propaganda influenced Negro votes, but resulted in no real action. In the legislature of 1875, most of the minor offices were filled with colored men. The Republican State Convention renominated Stearns for governor and adopted a platform arraigning both state and national governments for corruption, extravagance, and oppression. The state debt was only $1,329,757.68. The state taxation, which had been less than 2 mills on a dollar in 1861, had increased to 5 mills in 1867 and 13 7/10 mills in 1872. It was then reduced to 7 mills in 1875. The expenditures were but $190,000 against receipts of about $220,000. Thus, the Democratic cry of extravagance was not particularly effective. In the campaign of 1876, the Democrats won. McClellan, the ex-Confederate in the cabinet, celebrated in the Tallahassee Sentinel the victory of Hayes. In general, Florida presents no abnormal picture. There was some waste and high taxation, but it did not reach extremes. It had, as in other states, to contend with deliberate efforts to sabotage its advance. The Floridan said in 1871, "No greater calamity could befall the state of Florida, while under the rule of its present carpetbag, scalawag officials, than to be placed in good financial credit. Our only hope is in the state's utter financial bankruptcy, and heaven grant that that may speedily come. On the other hand, establish for the state financial credit on Wall Street, so that Florida bonds can be sold by Reed and Company as fast as issued, and you give these foul harpies a life tenure of these offices. The temporal salvation of the taxpayers is having scrip low, so that they can buy it to pay taxes with, and in having the state's financial credit low, so that Reed and Company can't sell state bonds so as to raise money with which to perpetuate their hold on office." There was bribery of Negro legislatures, as Wallace frankly shows, but he also says of his history, "The design of this work is to correct the settled and erroneous impression that has gone out to the world, that the former slaves, when enfranchised, had no conception of good government, and therefore their chief ambition was corruption and plunder, that it was white men, and not colored men, who originated corruption and enriched themselves from the earnings of the people of the state from the year 1868 to 1877. That the loss of the state to the National Republican Party was not due to any unfaithfulness of the colored people to that party, but to the corruption of these strange white leaders termed carpetbaggers. That the colored people have done as well as any other people could have done under the same circumstances, if not better." Wallace particularly laments the effect of corrupt leaders on the Negro. "The Northern machine politicians assert that it was the incompetence and unfaithfulness of the Negro voter to the Republican Party that brought about the unhealthy condition of things which made the solid South. It was these and kindred acts of the carpetbaggers which furnished the key to unlock the door that reveals the secrets of the solid South, while these very carpetbaggers were sustained by the Northern machine politicians. From the beginning to the end of Stern's so-called administration, it was contaminated with packed juries for political purposes, and during the last 2 years of his term, it became a patent fact that scarcely a person brought before the courts in the Black Belt counties could be convicted from the fact that the petite juries were mostly composed of the very worst element among the freedmen." This is not the whole truth. The reactionary planters, in whom Wallace and other colored men pathetically believed, were not honest or sincere in their advice to and support of Negroes. They encouraged lawlessness among poor whites, extravagance among carpetbaggers, and bribery among Negroes. They deliberately befouled the whole political nest in order to discredit its rulers and voters. "Shall I sing of liberty when there is no liberty? Shall I sing of freedom when there is none? Shall I sing love songs to young lovers who are slaves? My soul thrills, even as I think the laburnum in springtime thrills to link her chains of gold. I am lost in the great miracle which nature has endlessly wrought out of freedom. But man sits amid his own ruins, eating husks." Charles Erskine Scott Wood.